Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
I am talking with Catherine Grant. Do you prefer to be called Katie?
I usually am called Katie. Katie has always been what I've been called, but I chose Catherine because I'm KM for my children's books and Katie for my journalism. So I needed another name.
We're talking about your book, Sedition.
Yes.
Which is your first book for adults. What took so long? It's amazing.
I think this was the book I always wanted to write. And I think I wrote a successful children's book and then got a contract to write more children's books. So this one got slightly pushed aside.
I see. That makes sense. The paying gig takes precedence.
It does, because I wrote Sedition with no contract and was very unsure about what its reception would be. So I felt honour bound to write the other ones first.
Well, you must be pleasantly surprised then, because it's had a great reception. And so let's introduce our readers who, unlike you and I, haven't read the book. First, sedition. What is sedition? It's not a term, happily, that comes about that much anymore.
No. I mean, sedition is about an overturning or an undermining of authority, and it's usually used in a political context. But in 1794, when this book is set, there was a lot of political sedition around. We were just coming up to the climax of the terror in Paris in the French Revolution, mm-hmm. and in London, the coffee houses and the city of London just seethed with emigres and speculation and political sedition. People wanted to overthrow the existing order. And I was interested in domestic sedition because mm-hmm. quite often things that are happening on the outside are also reflected in the home.
Yes, yes. And so we meet four men who are sort of barrow boys done good.
They are. That's a very nice way of putting it. They're men whose provenance is, is the gutter, really, and they've hauled themselves up by their fingertips in order to get money and some kind of status. And now that they've hauled themselves up, they're damned if they're going to, them or any of their family, are going to sink back down again. They're men who take advantage of everything that London has to offer. Mm-hmm. They're absolute Londoners. They know London and they know how to use it. And they're traders, which is why they meet in a coffee house, which is where much trade was done.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like the different coffee houses, that sort of defined you. You know, since they went to that particular coffee house, they were that kind of person.
They were. I mean, it was the research on the coffee houses was really interesting. But the Virginia and Baltic in Threadneedle Street, which is where the men meet, was the one where Baltic traders met. So yes, there were different coffee houses for different trades. And the pianoforte maker, who also features in the story, he knows the different coffee houses, which is why he judges the trader who goes to buy the piano, which is central to the story. He judges him by the coffee house to which he feels he must belong.
Yes, yes. And the important thing, again, that drives the story is that these four men who are friends and sort of enmeshed business lives, they are all four, unfortunately, have only daughters.
They do.
So
they do. And they see these daughters as a business opportunity. Now, it's not to say that they don't love their daughters. It's just that everything to them is some kind of a business opportunity. And I think it's quite important to the book to realise that these men are not really selling their daughters. What they're doing, as Mr. Frogmorton, one of the fathers, tries to explain to himself, is they want to buy them a place of safety. They feel if they marry their daughters into the aristocracy, that the aristocracy, who always win out, whatever happens, that their daughters will be safe. So there'll be no sinking backwards. Mm-hmm. They'll have everything they need, but also they will be in this place of safety.
Exactly. So they decide for the promotion, shall we say, of their daughters. They decide on a pianoforte concert as a good venue to showcase their daughters in both dress and in a beautiful background and, you know, in elegance. What could be more elegant and charming than a young woman accomplished at the piano? But this is also at the time when the harpsichord is going out of fashion and the pianoforte is coming in. So one of the fathers, you know, devises this and goes to buy a piano.
That's right. So Vittorio Cantabile, who is an Italian who has come to London to make his fortune, having not made a fortune in his native land. And he is an interesting character because he runs a piano workshop in Tyburn. He makes pianos and he loves pianos. And they are his absolute life. And he likes to make them as perfect as possible. And he doesn't really like to sell them. He feels that nobody is worthy of his pianos.
Yes.
And he, of course, has a daughter, too.
Yes.
And Annie Cantabile is central also to the story. She is a damaged girl, physically damaged. She has a hare lip. And her physical damage is kind of mirrored by the damage Alethea Sawneyford, one of the other girls, she's sort of internally damaged, as it were.
Yes, and so then because the piano maker is so disgusted at who will be playing his piano, he sets about a plot to sort of undermine his own sort of sedition, to undermine the playing and promotion of these girls. And the interesting thing to me was that sort of seduction turned into sedition.
Yes. I mean, seduction and sedition are often quite closely linked.
Yes.
But the interesting thing for me was that they're slightly skewed in this book.
Yes.
In that the seduction and sedition are not exactly what the reader is expecting.
Exactly, yes. And everything gets undermined. And one of the things that comes about is for the women in the book, not so much the mothers, because they have a very different experience, but for the daughters is female sexual power. And there's nothing more seditious than female sexual power.
No, which was so interesting to explore. And I remember very early on in the book, when I showed it to a poet friend, he said, "You must be brave." So female sexual power is quite alarming, and trying to certainly was alarming for the people of the time, but also it is, you suddenly realise when you're writing about it how incredibly powerful it actually is.
Yes.
Something which we I suppose nowadays more take for granted, but when you start to delve into it, as certainly Alethea Sawneyford, the most powerful of the girls, does, you begin to realise yourself that female sexual power trumps all other power in many respects.
Yes, and yet it is the most fragile.
Yes, exactly. It can be destroyed in an instant.
Yeah.
But when it's operating, my goodness, and operating in hands like Alethea's, it's very powerful indeed.
Yes. And I have to say, it's such a good read. It's got everything. It has, you know, it's exciting and it's salacious and it's witty and it's clever and it's a wonderful, wonderful plot and a full story. You know, there's tragedy there. There's, you know, so we're not, you know, we're given a little bit of everything. It's wonderful.
RadioGorgeous.com.
I did want to talk to you about the relationship to your family, because the sedition did come up in your family. I believe your family was described as more than unusual perversity.
Yes. It was sometimes time ago. My family were Catholics, mm-hmm. and during the English Reformation, they refused to give up their Catholic faith, so they remained as Catholics, and that's why Lord Burghley, the treasurer to Elizabeth I, called them a family of more than usual perversity. We were fined and we were imprisoned and indeed died for the faith. And one of my five times great uncle, Francis Townley, was executed by hanging, drawing and quartering for supporting Bonnie Prince Charlie, who was, of course, the Catholic pretender to the throne, which the Hanoverian Georges had taken over in England. And Frank Townley supported Bonnie Prince Charlie because he was a friend of his, but also because he was a Catholic and he wanted Great Britain to be a Catholic country.
Yeah, and did that sort of Catholic outsider stance and sort of identity last in your family? Is that still a palpable thing?
It did, and you're absolutely right. You got the absolute word there, outsider, because for many, many years, well over sort of 200 or 300 years, Catholics were outsiders. They were always treated as being treacherous. They weren't allowed to hold public office. So not until Catholic emancipation in the middle of the 19th century were Catholics able to operate, as it were, as full UK citizens again. So my family did persist, absolutely. And, although they had some who fell away, as it were, the Catholic, just clinging to the Catholic faith was very, very powerful. It was a very powerful thing in my childhood, where in our drawing room, where we heard Mass every Sunday, there's a small oratory, small chapel at the end of our drawing room at home. There was a photograph frame, a little wooden leather frame, and inside this frame was a lock of Uncle Frank's hair.
Wow.
So we were visibly reminded every Sunday of the fact that our family had suffered for something it believed in.
Well, so sort of your own personal relic.
Yes, it was our personal relic, and it was a strange thing. I mean, as a child, I just accepted it was there. It didn't seem to me remotely spooky. It was just like everything else. It was just sort of there. But we were brought up very much as children from a family who had suffered much. And I remember once saying to my father, I thought I might not go to Mass. And my father said rather sharply, "Have you got anything better to do?" So it was just accepted, and that's what we carried on doing. I certainly wouldn't really say I'm certainly not a Catholic anymore. I don't think I hardly practice, but it's there. You can't expunge it. It's because it gets into your blood.
I'm Jewish,
there it is.
Yeah, I don't practice. But I feel like I'm culturally Jewish, and it sounds like you're culturally Catholic.
Exactly. Culturally and historically, mm-hmm. It's as if it's rude to give it up. I've had to suffer absolutely nothing.
And tell me a little bit about your growing up, because it sounded, I just said, five girls and a boy. It sort of sounded like the Bronte family or something in the Moors.
Yes, I mean, we were slightly luckily than the Brontes, and my brother, so far as I know, is not an alcoholic. But we there were six girls, one boy, and I think the boy comes in the middle, and I'm the third girl. The boy comes after me, and there are three more girls after him. This was a very traditional male primogeniture family, so the boy was important, the girls less so. But one of the interesting things I think about being one of many girls is the relationship between sisters or between girls, which I think is fascinating and about which I suppose I feel I know something. Mm-hmm. I was brought up amongst women, and I went to an all-girls boarding school. So I think the relationship between girls has always interested me, and it was something that it was really nice to explore in Sedition.
Yes, that does come out, because the four girls are forced together frequently, two of which are sisters.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's very nicely explored in the rivalries, the comforts, just having been thrown in proximity, what that does, what that doesn't do.
Yes, and of course, in those days, they would have seen almost nobody else. They saw each other, but their social circle was pretty limited. So there, I think it's really nice to explore, as you say, the rivalries, because girls love each other, but they hate each other at the same time. And even girls that love each other are rivals.
Yes, yes. That brings me to, because I thought it was interesting, it was a time of change and transition for the girls, which, you know, as a young adult, it always is. But also for their mothers, it was a real time of change. Tell me about the relationship of the three women. Obviously, Alicia's mother has passed away, but there's yes. these three other women.
They were, I wanted to make the mothers, because I'm a mother myself, and I think the relationship between mothers, and particularly mothers with daughters, is also very fascinating. And at the time of, in 1794, when these women are marrying off their daughters, they're not stupid women. They understand exactly what is happening, that they are going to lose their daughters. Because the daughters, once they're married into the aristocracy, will push their mothers away because their mothers are not aristocrats. But these are powerful women. Well, at least Mrs. Throgmorton is a powerful woman. Mrs. Brass, less so. She's been much hodden down by her husband. And Mrs. Dree is very nervy. But they do... They understand change, these mothers, and they understand their part in it, which is, in essence, no part. Mm. All they're doing is dressing their daughters and sending them out, and after that, they really have no, will play no further part in their daughters' lives. And that's why I think there's a recognition amongst them, and I think it does make them more sympathetic. I think there are very few people in the world who are completely unsympathetic and who have nothing to recommend them at all. And I hoped with the mothers, I wanted to show them as real people. They weren't just pawns. They were pawns in a game. They were part of the game, but they understood their role as changing and rather clung to each other.
Yes. Yeah, because they were the only sort of fixed constants in each other's world, especially since they, you know, they married husbands when they were young women. The men were not as wealthy as they were now.
Yes.
So they are in that same social status, but won't be getting any further.
Exactly. They're sort of stuck. They've got as far as they're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And they're perfectly contented with that. One doesn't get the impression that they're not contented with where they've got to. But they're at one with their husbands that they want the girls to be safe.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much, Catherine. This is amazing. I really did love, really, really did love the book, and I highly, highly recommend it.
Well, thank you.
But as you were in Glasgow, I do have to ask you the sort of seditious question of the day.
Yes.
Where do you stand on Scottish independence?
Well, I don't like borders, and I feel that we've done so well to make a country in the United Kingdom where we are the most successful kind of conglomeration of different nations, where we live together for the most part perfectly happily. So I'm hoping that there will be no border erected between us and our English neighbours. I suppose I am English, and I don't want to have to choose.
Yeah. Yes.
And I feel somehow that we've been so successful as a union that I would like to see the union preserved. Having said that, I love Scotland, so I hope that whatever happens, that Scotland will thrive and flourish. But I'm hoping that it will be within the union.
Yeah, same here. But, you know, I'm not Scottish, so I guess it's not for, certainly not for me as an American to say. Yes.
I think we're all slightly cut off if we start to cut off bits of our constituent parts.
I think you're right. Inclusion is the way forward.
That's the good word. Yes.
Yes, and that's probably the female perspective. we don't want anyone going away. We like to keep it all around.
Exactly. Yes. We want to gather people in.
Yes, exactly. Herd them up. Keep them together.
Keep them safe.
So, are you now that you've gotten this book that you wanted to get out? What's next? Are you continuing on the adult theme?
I am. I'm now writing another book, which it's certainly not the same, and it's set in more modern times. So that's a new challenge, because I think as a writer, you need to set yourself new challenges. Mm-hmm. This, I mean, Sedition, although it's my first book for adults, is my 10th book set in the past, or historical novel, I suppose. So I'm now trying to write a book which is rather more modern. We leap into the 20th century.
Right.
Which for me is just yesterday. So that's what I'm writing at the moment. And I think the most interesting thing for me is finding another voice, because the Sedition voice was so powerful in my head. I need a new voice for a new novel. And it's very exciting. I'm enjoying myself.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, and I imagine that from writing from an historical perspective, you have a different responsibility than writing from a more modern perspective, and it poses different challenges for you.
Yes, it does. It does. For a start, of course, the research is much easier in many ways, mm-hmm. But there's much more of it, and there's you have to remember things which you think, oh, I can't. I couldn't remember what year we got mobile telephones, mm-hmm. what year everybody had them. So there's been a lot of quite funny research. I suddenly realised that the 1980s, which I think is when this book is going to primarily be set, that also feels almost as remote as 1794. I think, gosh, what was I like in those days? I got married in the middle of the 1980s, had my children towards the end, and that feels like a different time.
Yeah, yeah, very different. I'm just, when you say that, I'm just thinking, oh, right, I was graduated from, university in 1989. I think I looked kind of like Cyndi Lauper at the time.
it's terrifying, isn't it, how life sort of, you think, oh, I must remember that. And that's one of the things I think is fascinating about writing. I never kept a very serious diary, but now, of course, I wish I had.
Yeah.
And I wish I kept a really boring diary, which just said what we'd had for dinner and what the house looked like, because I certainly can't remember.
Yes, yes, exactly. Was I serving, Mary Rose sauce, or,
Exactly. You're thinking, how much did the underground cost in 1988?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That's what you need, because that's what I think when you're writing historical novels, it's the detail that you really need. I mean, it took me days to research what the hangman's fee was.
Ah.
But I thought it was important to know what a hangman was paid in 1794.
Yes, yes. The hangman comes in one of the opening scenes, and it sets the tone as, whoa, this is not what you expected.
Yeah, well, I'm glad. Yes, I'm glad. I mean, I think perhaps because I was brought up in Lancashire, which is it's moorland, it is rather Bronte-esque. And I think rather like the Brontes, I have a slightly different view of life. I think when you live on those moors with that wind and the rain and the general bleakness of the moors, which I absolutely love, it's so unsoft, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I think it gives you a harder or a sharper, rather like the wind, it gives you a bit of a sharper edge. Mm-hmm. And that's how you look at things.
Yes, yes. The gloss is blown away.
Absolutely. All gloss blown away, yes.
It's been so wonderful to speak with you, Katie. Thank you so much for being on Radio Gorgeous.
Well, thank you, Donna. It's been a real pleasure.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
Mm-hmm.